Matter of Keith Isaac versus the Board of Trustees, Police and Firemen's Retirement System. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honor. Juliana.
Good morning, counsel, and welcome. Mr. Carosio, please.
Good morning, and may it please the court. We are here today because the estate seeks this court's intervention in the interests of justice to correct the repeated errors which improperly divested the decedent, Keith Isaac, and his estate of their ownership interest in $208,950,000 in retroactive pension benefits. These funds, due but not paid to the decedent at the time of Mr. Isaac's death, were unequivocally vested in Mr. Isaac before he passed away. The record is clear on this. The board confirmed Mr. Isaac's entitlement and vested ownership in these funds 42 days before he died, and later stipulated through counsel that he held a vested interest in these funds. Despite this, subsequent to the decedent's death, the board erroneously diverted the funds to his estranged spouse instead of to his estate. This action directly contradicted statutory mandates governing unpaid pension benefits. The law is unambiguous. The legislature, consistent with the laws of vested property rights at NJSA 43:16A-12.2, reserved to a retiree exclusive control over the disposition of unpaid pension benefits through them, allowing them to designate a beneficiary for such funds. The legislature placed no restriction on who a retiree could name as a beneficiary for these funds. Additionally, and critically, the legislature did not require an affirmative beneficiary designation from a retirement in order for the retirement to control the disposition of such funds. Rather, it anticipated, it contemplated that the retirement may not file any such beneficiary designation, and it clearly and unambiguously mandated that in such a case where there is no beneficiary designation, the unpaid pension benefits shall be paid to the estate. This is consistent with the laws of vesting and his property ownership rights. As recognized by the appellate division, Mr. Isaac never designated his estranged spouse or anyone else as a beneficiary of his unpaid pension benefits. His retirement application, completed 3 years before he became entitled to these funds, did not even allow for such a designation by its design, and as the board has acknowledged in sworn statements. Specifically, I'll refer this court to PA 86, the board's response to request for admission number 11, where they explained, Mr. Isaac did not have an option to designate anyone other than Mrs. Isaac as a beneficiary of unpaid retirement benefits, NJSA 43:16A-12.1. The board does not recognize a split between different types of benefits, example, pension benefits and retro funds. Additionally, the appellate division recognized at page 9 of its opinion, as explained by the board's counsel in her certification to this court, the materials show that unlike members of some other pension systems, PFRS members do not have an option to designate a beneficiary of the receipt of outstanding uncashed pension checks as of the death of the member in their applications for retirement. This is directly contradictory to the plain mandate of the legislature at section 12.2, granting the retirement broad rights to dispose of the property as he or she pleases, and the decedent's, and consistent with the decedent's vested property and ownership rights. It also confirms that in this case, at the time he filled out his retirement application form, the decedent could not have designated a beneficiary for his unpaid pension benefits on that form. He could not have done it. Accordingly, as a matter of law, the retro fund should have been paid to the estate. Nevertheless, in the face of the estate's challenge, the board has attempted to justify its mistake through inconsistent reasoning and statutory misinterpretation. While the appellate division correctly observed that the board's reasoning was flawed and that the retirement application could not be read as a beneficiary designation with respect to the unpaid pension benefits, It unduly prejudiced the estate when it similarly ignored the legislature's mandate that in such a situation, those funds are to be paid to the estate as a matter of law, and instead remanded the matter to the administrative law judge to conduct an evidentiary hearing on the decedent's probable intent. The specific mandate was as to whether the decedent likely would have intended his identification of his estranged spouse on the retirement form to convey a desire that she receive any unpaid pension funds due him upon his death. This exercise is irrelevant and improperly speculative for multiple reasons. First, the legislature did not require retirement to make a beneficiary designation with respect to unpaid pension benefits. The board did not allow for the retirement to designate a beneficiary on the retirement application form for unpaid pension benefits. The decedent had no predicate intent at the time he filled out the form 12 years ago and 3 years before he became entitled to these funds. The application on its face, by its design, did not provide notice to the applicant that it would operate in any way as a beneficiary designation for such vested funds. No party in this case is claiming that the decedent had an intention to designate a beneficiary for his unpaid pension benefits on his retirement application form. And most importantly, we know the decedent's actual intentions. We don't need to divine his probable intentions because, as the court and the parties are aware, between the period when the decedent was notified that he was going to receive these retro funds and his death, he created a last will and testament. It was 33 days after the board made its decision that the funds were vested in him, and sadly only 6 days before his death. And he didn't include his estranged spouse as a beneficiary in that will. And that will has been duly probated. Put simply, there is no nexus between the decedent's intent with respect to the disposition of his unpaid pension benefits and the retirement application form. To endeavor to divine the decedent's probable intent in such a circumstance and with respect to such a document, an administrative form not controlled by the decedent in any way, not informed by the decedent, would go well beyond the judicially prescribed limitations of the doctrine of probable intent. If the form is allowed in any way to govern the disposition of the decedent's unpaid pension benefits, it's an improper usurpation of his vested property rights and the right to dispose of his property by his will and in the manner contemplated by the legislature as set forth unambiguously at 12.2 and 12.3. It substitutes uncertainty with speculative inquiry. It substitutes uncertainty and speculative inquiry for the unambiguous mandate of the legislature.
Counsel, you mentioned the decedent's will. Was that part of the record before the board or the OAL or the APTIV?
It was part of the record before the APTIV, Your Justice, in terms of it was submitted in a certification as a motion for reconsideration. In terms of it being part of the formal record, it was, the board did have it. It was discussed. This case evolved interestingly in that no discovery was propounded upon us. Discovery was propounded upon them. It wasn't produced by them in discovery. However, it was probated. It's a matter of public record. It was jointly stipulated to, so they had reviewed it. It was reflected in the joint stipulation.
Counsel, if your argument under 12.3 is correct, is there any need to look at the will?
No, Your Honor. I'll continue with my argument. Accordingly, after 7 years of unwarranted delay, the state respectfully requests that the court affirm Mr. Isaac's property rights, direct the payment of $208,950 to his estate, and reject the improper remand for a probable intent inquiry. This court's intervention is necessary to bring long overdue finality to this matter.
Questions, anyone?
I just have one quick question. Counselor, under 12.2, how exactly was Mr. Isaac supposed to notify the board that he had a certain intention with regard to the retro funds? So I know that there is a procedure that the statute lays out. It doesn't appear that that procedure appears on the form. What was Mr. Isaac supposed to do if he wanted to notify the board about the disposition of retro funds?
Justice Hoffman, that would be speculation on my part. I'm not aware of any procedure the board had, and I think it was based on their fundamental misunderstanding that he didn't have the ability to designate a beneficiary. That's what they've said repeatedly, but that is incorrect. What he was supposed to do, according to the statute, is file a beneficiary designation for those funds with the board. There was no such beneficiary designation form, but the legislature anticipated that contingency and provided that in that event, contemplated it would happen, in that event, it gets paid to his estate. And so we have finality, we have certainty. And I think that the need to file or the intent to file a beneficiary designation is a bit of a, respectfully, a red herring. It was plainly error for the board to pay the funds to the estranged spouse. The estate challenged the board's actions. In responding to the board, its erroneous conduct by offering the board underscored its erroneous conduct by offering different and internally inconsistent reasons for its actions. Attempt to retroactively justify its mistake. First, the board claimed that since Mr. Isaac was approved for his retirement after his retirement date and after his passing, Roxanne Isaac was entitled to and received all of the retro money that would have been paid to the decedent. That's factually incorrect. He was approved prior to his death, and the funds vested in him during his lifetime per the handbook, per the joint stipulation, and that's not in dispute. That was a factually incorrect statement. And even if it wasn't factually incorrect, there's no statutory support for that position. Second, the board, in responding to discovery, as I just outlined, claimed that Mr. Isaac did not have the option to designate anyone than Mrs. Isaac as a beneficiary of unpaid pension benefits. The cite that they gave in support of that is section 12.1. Section 12.1 is the widow's survivor's pension. It went on to say the board does not recognize a split between different types of benefits, example, pension benefits and retro funds. But this court did recognize that section 12.1, the widow's pension in the Saccone case, this court held a retirement has no right to designate a beneficiary for that. It's an automatic pension that gets paid to the survivor on the decedent's death. It's separate and distinct. They were combining and conflating two different, one actually is not a benefit. The unpaid pension benefits were funds, money, compensation that he was entitled to, whereas the survivor's pension is a prospective, call it a death benefit. So that was legally and factually incorrect. It also directly contradicts the legislature at 12.2, which gave the decedent the unrestricted ability to designate a beneficiary. So by limiting his rights and lumping it in with the survivor's pension, what they did there was they took away a property right that belonged to him and which they had no right to do. They don't have the authority, the board doesn't have the authority to combine the categories of assets or to ignore the legislature's clear mandate. Third, in adopting the OAL decision, they've made the argument that their actions were reasonable and that they were in harmony of the statutory scheme. But again, reasonableness is not the standard here. We have unambiguous statutes that govern the disposition of these funds. In terms of harmony with the statutory scheme, the legislature said, you have the right to give this money to whoever you want. You can do it by beneficiary designation or without it, it can go into your estate because the estate is governed usually by a will, which is an ambulatory document. The decedent can control that during his lifetime. And so that was entirely consistent with providing finality so that what happened here doesn't happen. We're 7 years down the road now, and we're debating what should have happened to this money. But the legislature at 12.2 told us what should have happened. It should have went to the estate. In essence, the board's reasoning has been fatally flawed because it completely ignores the direct mandate of the legislature who allows a decedent in retirement to name anyone he wants as a beneficiary for unpaid pension benefits and contemplates that if he does not, that shall pass to his estate. The appellate division, it's respectfully submitted, incorrectly remanded this matter for a probable intent hearing. Appellate division correctly found that the retirement application form could not function as a beneficiary designation for the retro fund. That's at page 8, where it held the retirement application form that decedent completed does not state anywhere that the member who fills it out and who, as requested, identifies the member's spouse is designating that spouse as the recipient of any pension benefits that may be unpaid at the time of the member's death.
So is it your position that what that form reasonably could, we obviously don't know what was in his mind, but reasonably could be interpreted as simply asking whether there is a current spouse and nothing more?
Correct, Justice Patterson. It's asking for information. It's directing him to provide the name of a single individual without any ability to name anybody else but his spouse. And the title of that form says information on it. Yes. Additionally, the appellate division emphasized that the decedent's identification of his spouse's name on the form should not be overread to signify that he was choosing her to receive any unpaid pension benefits. Indeed, as I've previously said, it was impossible for the retirement application to function as a beneficiary designation for unpaid pension benefits because by its design, the form did not provide for any such designation. The board was under the belief that that couldn't happen. To that end, there's no evidence that the decedent intended the retirement application or Ms. Isaac's identification thereon for informational purposes to serve as a beneficiary designation. Her name doesn't appear anywhere in connection with the term beneficiary. It's only under that informational section. The use of the word information confirms it's not an affirmative act. It is not an affirmative testamentary act on his part, but rather informational in nature. As the appellate division noted, the name is requested as part of the design of the form, and only one person can be implemented there. So to the extent that they were prompting him to put the name there and he couldn't select anyone else, that prohibited him from exercising his rights. There's no express or implied or any other reference to unpaid pension benefits due to the decedent on the form. And the form does not indicate or recite that it will operate as a beneficiary designation for anything other than life insurance benefits, which clearly lays out the term beneficiary. And there, Ms. Isaac doesn't appear. Again, there's simply no nexus between the retirement application and the decedent's intent with respect to the disposition of his retro funds that became vested 3 years later.
Counsel, do you know if there's anywhere in the member guidebook that discusses the retro funds in any way?
To my knowledge, there is not. There is the discussion of when funds become due and payable. But in the Police and Firemen Retirement System Handbook, I do not recall a section that discusses that. And
but do you recall there is a section where they talk about choosing a beneficiary as to group life insurance and other sections, but there's nothing related to this area.
To unpaid pension benefits due to retirement. Yes, specifically what I was referring to. I'm not aware of anything in the handbook. It was therefore incorrect for the appellate division to remand the matter for the ALJ to make a factual determination as to whether the decedent likely would have intended his identification of his estranged spouse on the retirement form to convey a desire that she receive any unpaid retirement funds due to him upon his death. Probable intent is not appropriate here. Excuse me. First, the appellate division, like the ALJ and the board, is overlooking the mandate of the legislature that these funds, as a matter of law, belong to the estate, that no beneficiary designation is required. And so we don't need to invent.
Has the doctrine ever been applied, to a retirement application form governed by statute?
Not to my knowledge. So there is no need to invent a beneficiary designation here. The legislature told us that. There is the decedent's will. There is his estate. It can be paid to his estate. This result is logical and equitable because it's consistent with the laws of vesting. It allows a decedent to control the disposition of his funds through his will over the course of a lifetime. If we have a hearing and it's determined We have a probable intent hearing, and it's determined that his spouse was not intended as the beneficiary, which is respectfully submitted, would be the result. Then what happens? Who's the beneficiary? What do we do? What evidence is submitted? Who do we testify to? The answer is his estate. It goes. This is not uncommon. These are how private pensions function in policy documents for clarity. If no beneficiary is designated, then to the estate. If you didn't designate a beneficiary, strict compliance, it goes to the estate. Rather than have a hearing, the legislature told us how to figure this out and told us who the beneficiaries are. We look to the will. The remand runs contrary to the established body of law on probable intent. While the probable intent doctrine is a broad doctrine, it has limits that have been consistently enforced by this court, by the appellate courts, and by the trial courts, including that it cannot be used to create dispositive provisions out of whole cloth or to make up intentions for which there is no support. Here, they've essentially asked the court to engage in layers of speculation about a routine administrative act that happened 12 years ago and to potentially invent a fact or an act for which there is no predicate fact or act. There is no indicia that the decedent had any sort of intent, probable or otherwise, to name anyone as a beneficiary for unpaid pension benefits on the form. And as I've said, by its design, he couldn't have. The doctrine of probable intent has not been expanded to retirement application forms. Unlike a will, which is drafted at the request of a decedent and intended to embody his intentions, this is an administrative form. It's not language employed by the decedent. It's designed by an administrative agency. The decedent could not have anticipated it would serve to govern the disposition of his assets. And in fact, we have two different statutes here. There are statutes that codify the probable intent doctrine. They're in the probate code. Here, the legislature could have provided for a probable intent analysis. It didn't. It provided for clarity and said, it goes to the estate. And as I've said, we also know the decedent's actual intentions. We don't have to go through the costly and time-consuming, imprecise exercise of divining his probable intent had he been asked the question. 33 days after the board determined the decedent was entitled to the retro funds, he made his will, it's been duly probated, he died, and there's no better indicia of intent than what we have in this near contemporaneous act. Further proceedings regarding probable intent are manifestly unjust and inefficient. It essentially puts an undue burden on the estate. It requires us to do the impossible, to prove a negative, that a fact didn't exist. And critically, no one's claiming that the decedent intended to nominate his estranged spouse. So in conclusion, the legislature permitted the decedent to control the disposition of his funds. A beneficiary designation was not required, and there is indisputably no beneficiary designation. There is an estate and there is a will. The board should not be permitted to control the disposition of funds which the legislature left entirely to the decedent, not through tortured interpretations of unambiguous statutes, nor by circumscribing the decedent's rights through manipulation of the retirement application form. 7 years have passed since the decedent's property rights were unilaterally divested. There's no evidence of any intention on his part to designate a beneficiary, and a probable intent analysis is a prolonged exercise in incorrect speculation. In the interest of justice, the estate is entitled to finality and repose and to receive its full entitlement as the legislature intended. And if I have any time left, I'd like to reserve it for rebuttal if possible.
We ask counsel to reserve up front. We'll have you back if need be for very brief rebuttal. Thank you, counsel. Angela.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Members of the police and firemen's retirement system have inherently dangerous jobs. They risk their lives every day in the service of our communities. These risks and sacrifices are not just borne by the members, but also by their families. The legislature had this in mind when creating a statutory framework that protects and provide for the member's spouse and dependent children upon the member's death. For the past 58 years, the Division of Pensions and Benefits has relied on this statutory guidepost to protect and provide for the surviving spouse and children when determining the beneficiaries of a member's pension benefits. Seemingly, the division's interpretation and application of the beneficiary statutes in favor of the surviving spouse and children has remained unchallenged for 58 years until this matter before the court. Here, the appellate division found that the retirement application asking the member to identify his spouse in the marital survivor section of the application cannot be overread to signify that Keith Isaac was nominating his spouse, Roxanne Isaac, to receive the unpaid retro funds at issue here. The appellate division found that the retirement application is unclear and that the beneficiary statutes, NJSA 43:16-12.2, and 12.3 require something more. The Police and Firemen's Retirement System, in connection with the Division of Pensions and Benefits, will endeavor to create a form or a prompt within MBOS that specifically addresses the appellate division's concerns regarding the designation of these retro funds. Now, that will resolve this issue moving forward, but the question then becomes, how do we resolve this matter? The answer to that question was provided by the appellate division. The answer is a remand to the trial court for a fact-finding hearing to determine decedent's intent at the time he filled out his retirement application. In that hearing, the administrative law judge will consider extrinsic evidence and weigh the credibility of the testifying witnesses to determine whether the preponderance of the sufficient credible evidence in the record shows that Isaac intended to designate these retro funds to his surviving spouse, Roxanne. The board submits that an evidentiary hearing on the issue of intent is required because that issue really didn't come up and wasn't fully developed for the trial court, as it only really came up in the appellate division's decision. And so the board should be afforded the opportunity to get into the issue of intent and to determine what his intent was at the time he filled out that form. We ask that this court affirm the appellate division's decision. If your honors have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them at this time.
Where does the form designate Roxanne as the beneficiary?
So the Division of Pensions and Benefits has, for the past 58 years, considered his identification of his spouse under the marital survivor section as being a designation of his spouse for pension benefits.
So I just want to look at the plain language of the form with you. It designates Roxanne as, quote, the wife. Where does it, if at all, designate her as the beneficiary? Not what the board's interpretation is, but what does the form say?
Well, it does say for him to identify his spouse, but it says marital survivor information, and survivor information, I believe that is an indication of the survivor's benefit.
Can you survive a person but not be their beneficiary?
Yes.
So just designating survivor doesn't necessarily answer the question then, right?
Well, under the PFRS, the retirement statutes, there is the decedent cannot name anyone other than his survivor spouse.
For the pension.
For
under
the pension 12,
under 12.1.
Correct.
We're not talking about a pension here, though, are we?
We are talking about a pension, yes. We're
talking about benefits other than the widow's pension.
We are talking, and yes, there is a distinction, and that's what the appellate division was saying, that there is a distinction between unpaid benefits that were due the decedent at the time of his death and their survivor's benefit. And conceding, we do concede that fact, and that moving forward, there will be a designation for these unpaid retro funds.
Understood. So how is an applicant looking at this form to know that by identifying their spouse, they have designated someone for retro funds?
The appellate division did say that it's unclear what they were designating when they identified their spouse. And but it's been the division's policy for the last 58 years that by nominating the spouse, you're nominating her for or him for
so both. That's their position. Is it stated anywhere?
It is not.
So how is an applicant to know whether it's been 58 years or some other period of time that they're designating someone by simply identifying their spouse as a wife?
There is no explanatory text in the retirement application. However, we don't know what his intention was, if he knew what exactly he was designating by nominating her as his spouse.
And the form has a location for beneficiaries for the life insurance, but says nothing about beneficiaries for retroactive funds, correct?
Correct.
And when an applicant is filling out this form, it's unclear whether an applicant is even thinking about the fact that there might be retroactive funds. When a police officer or a firefighter files their application for retirement benefits, the expectation is they're going to retire and begin receiving their benefits. In this case, and I'm guessing some other cases, but I'm thinking the majority of cases, that application's approved and they begin receiving benefits. In this case, there was a years-long delay, which is the only reason why there were retroactive benefits in the first place. So it's difficult to conceive that an applicant who is seeking to retire and expecting to get benefits is thinking of the possibility that there will at some point even be retroactive benefits in existence, because their thinking is they're going to retire right now and begin receiving benefits. Don't you, isn't that a logical, wouldn't that be a logical thought that these applicants have while making this application?
Yes, it is logical. And while it's certainly difficult to conceive that they would have some intention as to the retro funds at the time they filled out their application, if those retro funds hadn't vested or weren't even really an issue upon their application for retirement allowance, it's not impossible. And I think that's what the appellate division is saying, that we simply don't know what we don't know. We don't know what he intended when he designated her as his
And I just want to confirm, you said earlier that you could concede, that the board concede that there is a difference between the retroactive benefits and the survivor's benefits. So that's a different position, it appears, than the board took in responding to the interrogatories that counsel for the estate noted earlier, where the board indicated the board does not recognize a split between different types of benefits, e.g. pension benefits and retro payments. That is, now the board is taking the position that there is a difference between those benefits.
Correct. And that we didn't cross appeal for a petition for cert to this court. And so the appellate division's decision is that there is a distinction between survivor's benefits and unpaid retro benefits.
And the statutes make a distinction. I mean, it's pretty clear in section 12.1 and 12.2 that there is a clear distinction between those benefits and how those benefits are paid and other characteristics of those benefits.
Yes, that's correct.
If you're correct that we don't know what his intent was, don't sections 12.2 and 12.3 tell us the money goes to the estate because no one has been designated the beneficiary?
Well, I think the appellate division found that we don't know whether he intended to designate, there might very well have been a designation when he identified his spouse at the time he filled out his application.
Where is the designation?
When he filled out the informational section, marital versus slash survivor information.
So if that argument doesn't prevail, doesn't the statute tell us what happens next? That the money goes to the estate?
Yes, after an evidentiary hearing as to what his intent was.
Where does the statute tell us that you need to have an evidentiary hearing?
Well, that's not in the statute per se.
What does the statute tell us?
The statute says if there is no nomination, but the appellate division is saying that there very well might have been a nomination.
The statute is very, very specific as to what a nomination could consist of. It specifically says, upon the death of a retirement, any unpaid benefits due him, So you're acknowledging at this point, as Justice Pierre-Louis pointed out, that unpaid benefits due him are distinct from the survivor's benefits discussed in 12.1, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so any unpaid benefits due him shall be paid in one lump sum to such person, if living, as he shall have nominated by written designation, duly executed and filed with the Board of Trustees, otherwise to the executor or administrator of the retirement estate. And so your opponent's position is here, there is no written designation duly executed and filed with the Board of Trustees specifically nominating the former spouse to any unpaid benefits. And therefore the statute says it goes to the estate. How would a hearing help with that? No matter what, a hearing will not reveal any written designation duly executed and filed with the Board of Trustees nominating Roxanne for these specific unpaid benefits, correct?
Well, it's the board's position that his identification of her in his retirement application could have been, his intention could have been to have nominated her for pension benefits generally, which also includes the unpaid retro funds.
But the legislature seems to disagree with that, in that the legislature is using very particular terms like written designation, duly executed and filed with the Board of Trustees, nominating someone to these specific unpaid benefits. The legislature does not seem to be saying, you know, whoever the board decides or whoever the board thinks should get it or whoever the decedent might have wished to get the benefits. So how will a hearing help us figure out if there was one of these written designations duly executed and filed with the board that nominated the former spouse to these unpaid benefits?
Well, I believe that it might be in part of the code, but hold on one second. It discusses that a nomination shall be on a form satisfactory to the board, and that's what the board's position was, that this retirement application was a form satisfactory to it for the designation.
12.3.
I'm sorry? Right.
You're reading from the first paragraph of 12.3 there.
That's correct, yes.
So the third paragraph says, any amounts due for which there is no beneficiary, ... shall be payable to the estate. So we come back to the question, has there been a designation of a beneficiary? And if not, doesn't the money go to the estate?
Again, I think that the appellate division found that there very well might have been a designation.
Were they right?
I believe so, yes.
Okay.
Even though here they're using the word beneficiary, and so the whole application is only 2 pages long, right? It's like this internet form and it's very, very brief. And in the record, it only appeared to be 2 pages long. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And the only use of the word beneficiary that I saw was the word primary beneficiaries listed under the section titled life insurance information, correct?
Right. That specific language, correct.
Okay, and so there, the decedent listed 4 of his 8 children, correct?
Correct.
So how could there how could a hearing possibly indicate to us that the real beneficiary was Roxanne when the only place on the form it even uses the word beneficiary is with regard to life insurance and the decedent lists his children and not Roxanne?
Because the preceding section does ask him to identify his spouse for the survivor.
But that's it. We already agreed, and the board now concedes that survivor's benefits are completely different. Everything in 12.1 has nothing to do with the retro benefits that we're talking about, correct?
Right.
And as Justice Wehner Apter read from 12.2, there's very specific language that the legislature enacted with regard to how a nomination of a beneficiary for any unpaid funds shall be made. Can you tell us, as attorney for the board, how retirees have made this beneficiary designation? I know you noted that going forward, the board is going to do something to change the form, to create a new form. It appears that there has never been a specific form for the designation of a beneficiary for unpaid benefits. In the past, how have retirees made this designation that in 12.2 indicates it needs to be a written designation, and then in 12.3 specifically notes that it shall be in writing on a form satisfactory to the retirement system? How have have retirees in the past made this designation. And I'm aside from the board's position that it's on this form that says nothing about beneficiaries for that, those retro funds.
The best answer I can give you is that the designation for those unpaid retro funds was in that section for marital and survivor information.
So there's never been a retiree that submitted a notarized letter, a notarized form indicating if for some reason there are unpaid benefits that are due to me and I pass away before those benefits are paid, I am designating or nominating this person as the beneficiary of those unpaid benefits. It's always been the case that it's whoever's listed under marital / survivor information that doesn't say beneficiary at all.
To the best of my knowledge, that's correct.
Are there other cases like this one?
No. Not to my knowledge.
So once the form is adjusted and has clarity in the way that you've described,
Yes. This
will be a one-off?
Correct. And I would like to mention that these beneficiary forms are controlling. Even if a decedent puts in their will that they want...
But this isn't a beneficiary. I mean, I think that's the problem. We have very specific language in a statute. I understand your position is... the appellate division's right. What the appellate division said is correct. We need to have a hearing. We're looking at a statute and what the statute states. The statute indicates that a beneficiary needs to be designated and nominated by the retiree. We have a form here that says nothing about a beneficiary designation for unpaid benefits.
Correct. And that there could be, most likely, this would be a very short hearing on what his intent was. I would note, however, that while not before the record before your court, before your honors, before the Office of Administrative Law, it was revealed that Roxanne had waived her elective share under the will, and that she had spent the $208,000 because she was in receipt of that $208,000. She spent it partially on tuition for her children and on joint property taxes on joint property that she owned with her decedent spouse. And so that raises the inference that she and he may have had a conversation as to, okay, well, you're getting this $208,000 and the rest of it is going to go under my will and I'm disinheriting you from that. So we don't know what conversations might have taken place. But certainly the equities are, I believe, in favor of having some type of intent hearing to determine whether she was the proper beneficiary.
Could you clarify for me, the first time he learned that he was entitled to unpaid benefits was after the board approved his application retroactive to sometime in 2014, right?
Correct.
So at that time, if he wanted to designate his wife as the beneficiary and comply with his obligation under 12.2, how would he do that?
If he wanted to designate his spouse for the unpaid retro funds?
Right.
It's the board's position that he already did that.
I understand. I'm saying he couldn't have done that, actually, if he didn't even know he was entitled to unpaid funds, but set that aside for a minute. Let's say he learned about it when the board approved his application. What could he have done at that point if he wanted to nominate his wife to be the beneficiary of those unpaid funds?
He filled out a beneficiary designation form.
Where is the form? What form?
The retirement application.
So he'd have to fill out another application for retirement allowance, even though he's already been approved for that.
No, again, the board's position is that the retirement application is a proper.
I understand that, but I'm trying to just practically think about what he could have done when the board finally approved his application if he wanted to name his wife as a beneficiary of his unpaid funds. What does he do? What form does he use to do that?
I don't have an answer for that.
Your answer, I thought earlier, was there was no such form. There was no way for him to do that because the board had taken the position that there were no separate kinds of benefits. And so you couldn't designate someone just for unpaid funds and not for something else, right? Isn't that the position that the board took below and before OAL?
The board's position was that this retirement application was the designation.
So flip the question around. What if he wanted to designate his children for the retro funds? How could he have done so?
I don't know. I don't believe he would have been able to.
And that's because the only form he can use is the form that has been approved, and that form doesn't provide an option for that.
Correct.
But the statute specifically allows for a retiree to nominate by written designation and duly executed someone to be the beneficiary.
Right.
But he, if he wanted to, he would not have been able to do that, even though the statute specifically allows him that ability.
Correct, because the policy at the time was that they were.
So the policy benefits. Was in, did not follow the statute.
The policy followed the statutory framework of benefiting surviving spouse and children.
For survivor's benefits, we're talking about unpaid benefits under 12.2. It's pretty clear that a retiree has the ability to designate someone as a beneficiary. And I mean, whether it's a life insurance policy, we're familiar with designating people as beneficiaries. It's usually the case that if the holder of the policy, the person in charge of the account, they're able to change the beneficiary at any given point. But it has, is it your answer that it was the board's policy that he could not do that?
That's correct.
Can I follow up on that? In the member handbook, it says that in order to choose a beneficiary under the group life insurance portion, that when a member is enrolled, the new member's estate is the group life insurance beneficiary until the NJDPB receives a new designation of beneficiary. And that phrase, designation of beneficiary, is in italics. Is that a separate form, or are we talking about the same one that's included in the application for retirement benefits?
There is a separate form that very much follows the structure of the retirement application.
Is it labeled designation of beneficiary?
It is.
And does that specifically relate to group life insurance somewhere on there, or does it simply say designation of beneficiary as a general form?
Just a moment. I don't want to speak out of turn. Because
if it exists, then it's possible that the board did have a form for choosing a beneficiary for various reasons, if it didn't isolate group life insurance, retro funds, anything else.
I know that there is an on the form, which is included in. My certification that was provided to the appellate division, Judge Sabatino had asked for any information that would have been available to Mr. Isaac at the time that he filled out his application in relation to designations of beneficiaries.
Do you have an appendix citation for that?
Yes. So this was not a part of my appellate division appendix. This was like a separate set of documents that was provided to the court upon request. It stated March 6, 2024, and it's Exhibit D, Designation of Beneficiary Form. And if we go to that form, on the top it says Designation of Beneficiary, and this is obviously a form that members can use prior to filing an application for disability retirement or service retirement, whatever it is. For them to designate their group life insurance benefits is the first section, and it says primary.
Sorry, can you say it again? What's the title of the form?
Sure, designation of beneficiary. And the next section says group life insurance benefits and has primary beneficiaries and contingent beneficiaries. And then the next section says pension benefits, primary beneficiaries and contingent beneficiaries.
Does that cover this case, this situation?
I don't believe so, no.
What does it cover?
This would cover a situation, I think, when you're unmarried and it's prior to you filing out your retirement application, because you can, if you're a member of PFRS and you're unmarried, you can nominate someone other than your spouse to receive your pension benefits.
So it only applies to pension benefits. Pension
benefits, which the division at the time considered it to include survivor's benefits and any other unpaid retro funds, such as what's at issue here.
How usual or unusual is the setting we have here with these unpaid retro funds?
It's not something that happens a lot. I will say that when there is litigation between a member and his former employer, the division often stays a retirement application pending the outcome of the litigation because it could have an impact on the member's retirement allowance or receipt of retirement whatsoever. And so that does happen. But as far as a disagreement between the surviving spouse receiving these unpaid
I wasn't referring to that part of it, but just simply how is this? It seemed like a fairly unusual circumstance that led to this problem. I'm just wondering if
it's unusual, but it does occur.
Thank you.
Council, would that form that you just identified be considered a written designation duly executed and filed with the board?
Yes.
But there was no such form submitted in this case, correct?
Correct. The only form, well, the last form that we have regarding designation of beneficiaries is the controlling form, and that is the retirement application.
So if after Mr. Isaac had filled out the original form, if he had filled out that form and designated his children as the beneficiaries for pension, who would have gotten the retro funds?
His spouse.
Even if he identified that he wanted them to receive the retro funds, specifically in that second form that you said was would be considered a written designation duly executed and filed with the board?
It's my understanding that if a member has a surviving spouse, that the pension benefits, which the division considered to be both survivor's benefits and unpaid retro funds, would go to the spouse regardless of what the member designated, say, in this form. If he designated his children, that wouldn't have been a proper designation.
Do you know when the new form is going to be made available?
I don't know, but I'm going to endeavor to get it done as soon as possible so that this issue doesn't continue to be an issue.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add, counsel?
No, Your Honors. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Rosha, did you want to offer rebuttal? Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement.